This is The Stark Truth, hosted by Robert Stark, brought to you by StarkTruthRadio.com. Robert Stark is an American journalist and political commentator. You can listen to his podcast at www.StarkTruthRadio.com.
This is Robert Stark. I'm joined here with Paul Bingham. We're going to be discussing a documentary project that he has. It's about basically chronicalizing the death of the American heartland. Paul, it's great having you back on. It's been a while.
Thank you, Robert. It's great to be back on. And yes, the project is tentatively called The Death of the American Heartland, about the economic destruction and decay of the central part of the Americas and the southern part of the Americas.
And for the people in the audience who are new to this and they haven't listened to the shows that you did in the past, can you give the audience a brief introduction to yourself?
Yeah, I'm a writer, poet, and lately I've been trying my hand at filmmaking. I've written a couple of books that are currently available on Amazon. One is Down Where the Devil Don't Go, and the other one is called Black House Rocked. And I have a book of poetry in the works that will be out any year now that is called Strip Club Poetry. And I travel a lot in my business. And
Were you able to use the picture of the painting that I sent you for that book on strip club poetry?
Yeah, I'm going to. I mean, that's art by Robert Stark, cover art, but I just never have published it. But yeah, I mean, that's a done deal.
Have you gotten footage for the documentary so far? It's based on your travels through different parts of the Midwest and the South. Where have you gone?
Oh, I primarily travel through Kansas, Missouri, Texas, Oklahoma, Arkansas, New Mexico, Nebraska, Indiana, Illinois, Kentucky, Tennessee, and Alabama and Louisiana.
So you've gotten footage? Have you interviewed people?
I have a lot of interviews. I have a lot of footage. I'm wanting to, at this time, do some more orderly interviews because everything heretofore has been shot in a very haphazard manner because I'm traveling, and I want to do some focused and planned shooting for the documentary and interview some people of note who are living in the heartland as well and do some formal interviews.
I'm sure it's more difficult during the quarantine, but in the future, there'll be more opportunities.
Well, I traveled to Indiana just before this all started. I'm known as essential, and that's the term that's really bothered me since the beginning of this, because what most people don't realize is most people aren't essential, and we're determining at this time, due to the coronavirus outbreak, who is, and this quarantine, who is actually essential and who is non-essential. And the non-essential people we find are people who are usually economic units that are not valuable to the status quo. And I've interviewed many of these people in past times. They might have been considered valuable for their consumption ratios, but in other words, how much they can consume. But now we're not really needing consumers to prop up the economy anymore. So these people are basically unessentials. And in other words, if you're not essential, you may be disposable. And I think that's what we're seeing right now, is the determination whether people in the United States, in the heartland, are either essential or disposable.
And the quarantine is just, it's just much more open about it, and it's kind of accelerates the process in that way. Are you familiar with that book, Bullshit Jobs and the Bullshit Jobs Theory?
Yeah, and I honestly believe that it's a lot, and this goes back to people who will unironically quote Buckminster Fuller, whom I know you're familiar with, who's talking about make work jobs back in the 60s and 70s, and at the same time, they herald the advent of feminism and women in the workplace, and that's not necessarily germane to our subject at hand, but what you quickly find is that most people who are non-essential are often women, and a lot of jobs that currently exist today are deemed unessential or not essential are jobs designed for women. So
I don't know. I've heard different theories, because there was that whole concept of like a man session about how economic changes were disproportionately harming men, and then I've also heard that women were disproportionately to be laid off during the quarantine. So I've actually heard different theories. But the thing is, also like with the whole economic model, is there's the cultural aspect of feminism, and then there's just the economic practicality that basically one head of a household can't support a family.
Yeah, it's impossible in the heartland for one individual on even a well above minimum wage to support a four-person household of a unit of mother, father, and two children. And so you can make $15 an hour, you can make $20 an hour. It's not necessarily going to be adequate, because the power of the dollar in every sense is so atrophied that you have to make $40 in order to an hour to have a semi-decent existence.
Even once the quarantine is over, a lot of these jobs will probably be gone for good. You will see a lot of corporations are streamlining, and the people they laid off, they won't necessarily rehire. We'll see definitely a trend, an increase, an acceleration of the trend of automation.
It's going to be a very interesting near future to observe, and that's something I was going to talk a little bit about, because one of the things that I do is often I get bored traveling, and I travel on different roads, and there are a lot of restaurants that probably won't be reopening that were struggling before the coronavirus hit, and having the restaurants this quarantine go on and be being shut down with no savings or any kind of monetary support aside from the Trump bucks, so-called, they're going to go out of business. And there are a lot of tourist venues in the Midwest that are also going to go out of business. I think most of the important businesses are going to be able to maintain for now, but nevertheless, we are seeing a period in which a lot of businesses that Trump heralded were going to come back, this factories and so forth, are actually continuing their slow death.
What's actually happened with Trump is he did put some sanctions on China, but those jobs, they're basically going to other nations other than China, like India and Vietnam. Very few of them have actually come back to America.
Yes, and you'll see, like last year, there were a lot of factories that put out signs, "We are hiring," but in big banners. You know, Trump's got the economy going. We're hiring again. You know, all these various steel fabrication and other factors, but they're not hiring general workers, but they kind of put those banners out because most of those small factories owners are pro-Trump, and so they're putting out we're putting America back to work and all that. But as a matter of fact, they're only hiring a few specialists. They're not just doing a big business and needing to double their labor force or even increase their labor force. What they're hiring is specialists. But nevertheless, they're going to pull out this huge banner like, we're putting America back to work. So it was kind of a fraud that went on last year, and it created a bubble of people thinking that we were approaching something closer to full employment, which in fact we were not, as this coronavirus and the quarantine has proven.
Yeah, for sure. Were you an initial supporter of Trump, or were you skeptical of him from the very beginning?
I had stuff going on in the 2016 election, so I missed most of it. Like, I had business interests, and so I really paid very little attention. I predicted Trump would lose in lose the primaries and the general election, so I was totally off base with Trump. But again, I wasn't paying a great deal of attention. As long as we're on the subject of elections, I will tell you, in all my travels, I was on a road in Oklahoma, and I saw one Yang gang sign, and it was kind of funny. Not in a just in an amusing way, because that was the only Yang gang sign I'd ever run across, and I almost pulled in to talk to the people.
Oh yeah, were you a Yang supporter?
I'm not really into the professional wrestling anymore. I mean, I supported Ron Paul, but I just don't do professional wrestling anymore, you know. But I thought Yang had a good platform, and I was certainly enjoyed his spiel and his a lot of his ideas. I just felt like he made a few major mistakes he wasn't able to pull significant support away from Bernie. And that was his primary problem. But I think Yang failed to realize, because he is a very earnest individual, that he simply did not have a proper audience. And what I mean by that is that you have to work with such dregs of society when you're campaigning in either party. And isn't that Americans, for the most part, are dregs in general. So he had such poor material to work with. In other words, the people he had to attract.
Yang did go, I wouldn't say he's full on woke, but he did try to appeal to some of that crowd, the woke crowd in the Democratic Party.
Well,
or just he wanted good relations with the Democratic establishment.
I'm not even talking about the woke crowd. The general American populace, you offer them $1,000 and they still turn it down. So $1,000 a month or whatever. So at this point, you realize you're dealing with something less than human, and then you're dealing with the subhuman, and I don't think Yang was, at his age, is able to internalize the simian or the low nature of the American mind.
Yeah, I've heard that theory before, but can you explain specifically what you mean about the nature of the American mind and how Americans would contrast with people in other parts of the world?
Well, and again, this is traveling through America. We've heard from conservatives for several generations about the dumbing of the American mind and about this, how American schools are teaching kids so many useless things, and the curriculums are being dumbed down. Well, that process has culminated at this time in basically producing a generation that is finally completely ignorant and basically incapable of rational thought, or in most cases only prepared to be a consumer. So those people are no longer rational political actors.
And the thing is, as you pointed out earlier, is they don't necessarily need all those consumers.
No, exactly. But people don't realize that they're the consumers, but they can't protect themselves anymore because they don't have the intelligence or the knowledge to be basic voters anymore.
Since you were on Yang, I mean, I support the UBI, but I'm also skeptical. I don't think at the same time, I think even with a UBI, we'd still have a lot of these problems of a sort of planned obsolescence.
Well, I'm actually a Luddite in the sense that I don't believe we're going to achieve total automation, because the total automation of society will be outweighed by the fact that so many people are reverting to a pre-human form. So we talked about transhumanism and post-humanism, but most people are reverting to pre-humanism. So to levels prior to the civilization of mankind. So what are, you know, what's going to happen? Once there, it's like a seesaw and the balance is going to tip either way. And yes, there are some people in the middle of it who are educated and rational and so forth and so on. But you have your transhumanists on one side, but there are far more millions of people who are completely borderline human. So the scale is going to, you know, it's going to be like a seesaw ride for a while. But to your point, the people in Heartland America, by and large, are no longer necessary, because it's true that they could run the factories with far fewer people than there
are. And you're
talking
about without, even without automation and outsourcing?
Yeah, without automation, they could run the factory on one-third of the people that currently work in those factories. And they could run all the farms with one-third of the labor that they're running the work with now. So, and that's not just an imaginary statement. I'm just pulling out of thin air. What we're seeing right now, what you see in the heartland, is a slow conglomeration of farmland as a few corporations and large farmers start to buy up every possible chunk of land, farmable, arable land in the area, in the regions, and push people into cities in which they live in these developments and, you know, these housing developments. And the small landowners are being eliminated because they're not functional. They can't produce crops, and so they're basically useless. But a large farm can of hundreds of thousands of acres, a large corporation can produce a vast amount of resources from those land with only one or two people using tractors. Literally, a handful of people can produce, you know, millions of tons of corn and soybeans and so forth without help from anyone else. So that renders everyone else around them redundant, and they really have no purpose in life. We can't create an artificial purpose for them in life. What we have right now is LARPing, you know, which everybody is live-action role-playing, imaginary job that's not real. But even if they didn't, if they had a purpose in their own mind, there would be no actual important purpose for them to exist, because we have an overpopulated country, and there's simply not, it's not that we, that there's a shortage of jobs. As a matter of fact, there's not enough jobs, there's not enough people to fill the few jobs that are around, because those jobs are so important and so selective that there's only a small pool of people that can fill those roles.
So if so many of the American people are obsolete, why do you think there's this really strong push by corporations and the establishment for mass immigration?
I truly believe that they're trying to do the whole... I think, well, first of all, we know from past experiences that if you create the perfect storm in immigration within two generations, those immigrants will largely disappear. And not just by assimilation, but by the third generation, they will be below reproduction. Their reproduction rate will be below replacement. So those immigrants, their descendants will not be able to reproduce at the same rate to even sustain their original numbers. And we've seen this with every immigration wave in the United States. Their children cannot reproduce at the same rate. So the perfect storm allows them to use the immigrants to help destroy the existing peoples in the United States who are also unnecessary, and then it's easier to get rid of the immigrants.
You have these kind of neoliberal pundits like Matt Iglesias, who advocate for 1 billion U.S. citizens by within like 50 years, but you don't think you so you don't actually think that's what the establishment wants.
I don't think Matt Iglesias is that important. I think the establishment is very clear with their aims. Like a lot of long-term United Nations projection maps will show you that they project large areas of the world and the United States to be vacant in 80 years or in 100 years. And I think we're well on our way to seeing that happen. And I think a lot of pundits are irrelevant to the discussion. What I look at is, like in the area of the Midwest, and I look at individuals who are looking toward the future, and there are a lot of people right now who may be buying up thousands of acres of land and planning to use their corporation to run it for their family's benefit in the future. And what will eventually happen is, yes, they will run that land. They will own and control hundreds of thousands of acres. But the fact that a smaller number of people will, every generation, control more land will be easier. It will make it easier to eliminate that small number of people from controlling the land. In other words, a lot of small landholders are harder to deal with than a few big landholders. And so those big landholders will be eliminated in due course.
There was a foreclosure crisis that happened about 12 years ago. And then prior to that, I think it may have been back in the Reagan era or maybe Bush Sr., I forget the exact date. But a lot of the small farms, there was a foreclosure crisis where involving the small farms, and then there was this mass consolidation.
Yeah, and that's just going to continue over and over again until the population, and, you know, it'll go along in cohesion with the population decreases, which I don't think, like I said, Matt Iglesias is pretty, he's just not important to anybody's worldview. You have to see the pattern of our actual elites and how they run things and how they intend to run things. And, you know, the big elites don't necessarily talk to the small elites. I explain to people, if you're not a millionaire, you really don't matter in the United States. And I know a bunch of millionaires, and they feel like everybody is out to get them. And, yes, they are wealthy, but it's like they live the kind of life that middle-class Americans used to live. So...
yeah, being a millionaire is just like the new middle class, that's all.
Yeah, and so those are the people that feel as though they have a target on their backs, but nonetheless, they aren't that important. But nobody talks to them and considers their long-term plans. And then you have the multimillionaires of 100 million or more over them, and then you have the billionaires above them, and there are a lot more billionaires than people know about because
they hide their assets.
A lot of people hide their assets. There are, I couldn't even hazard a guess to how many billionaires there are in the United States.
With hiding the assets, that's why there was some skepticism what Bernie was proposing about whether an asset tax would work and how you'd collect it.
I think there's a lot of solutions that could work if they were implemented by the right group of capable people.
Yeah, whether... I think Bernie, he had a lot of his ideas were good, but I honestly don't think he would be the most capable person to implement them.
Well, Bernie didn't have any capable people around him to implement them either. You know what I mean? What we saw from the Ron Paul campaign, Robert, which I know you were
proxy
to it,
was that
not a whole lot of the people involved in the Ron Paul campaign and the Ron Paul movement were that. Over time, it turned out that none of them ever amounted to a hill of beans, we'll put it that way.
They got, like, Justin Amish elected. He doesn't oppose really any serious opposition to the establishment. And a lot of the Ron Paul, like the Ron Paul types, they had some presence in, like, libertarian think tanks, but then that was kind of purged by more, like, the Koch brother types.
Yeah, They were utterly impotent.
Exactly.
And I don't think there's a single person from the Ron Paul campaign that I knew or worked with that I still talk to. Some of them are passed away, may they rest in peace, and a lot of them are just basically shitlibs. None of them ever came to amount to anything. None of them, and here's something else I'll offer. Nobody talks about Austrian economics anymore, which, it's obviously Austrian economics are kind of stupid. I didn't even believe in Austrian economics when I was a Ron Paul supporter because, I'm not a person who believes in the free market. But, nobody... Austrian economics, I never hear anybody talk about Austrian economics.
No, not at all.
They've been completely removed from everybody's mindset. But the point of the matter is, I think a lot of plans from different people, be it Yang, be it Bernie, be it any innovator, could be implemented, but they have to be implemented by a particular cast of people who are dedicated and disciplined and capable. And I don't think... there's no group of Americans that you could get together that are dedicated and disciplined and capable of any ilk or race or creed or political bent.
And with this planned obsolescence, but I don't think it's going to be like an outright genocide, but I think what will happen is just people will be granted subsistence living just to get by, like basic food and shelter, and then with a kind of a declining birth rates, they'll just sort of gradually be phased out, like a slow, maybe you could say like a slow genocide.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a slow, controlled genocide, and it's working according to plan, and everything is going, at this point, there's nobody you can talk to about have their own genocide. In other words, you can't go to these people and say, white genocide, or...
You're not even talking about it in ethnic terms. You're saying it's everyone.
I think every ethnicity is being targeted because I think they want to decrease the population by, 100 or 2 or even 200 million. And I realize the population of America is not that high or not as crazy high as China and these other countries, but I don't think our elites take the wars with or the whole conflicts with other nations seriously, because they're also invested in other nations as well. And moreover, you have a situation in which America is basically a, like South Africa is a, it's a breadbasket. It's not meant to be a suburb, and it really doesn't work that well as a suburb.
What do you mean by breadbasket versus a suburb? Like, which country would be a breadbasket? Because the United States does produce a lot of food.
Well, we look at Egypt, where people largely live in cities, and or South Africa, or what was formerly Rhodesia, in which people largely live in cities and the countryside is largely agricultural. And then we look at America right now, in which the countryside is being eaten up by suburbanization, and these cities are spreading. Some of these cities are 15 to 20 to 30 miles wide, 40 miles wide. The city limits are spread in all directions in order to get more federal funding so they can have public water and public sanitation and all this at higher rates. And they're eating up the farmland right now for building houses and McMansions and all that. But I don't think that is feasible in the long run. I think the elites are just letting that go on right now. But in the long term, America is just all the... that is going to go away, and America is just going to be used as a breadbasket for the world. In other words, it's just going to be farmland.
You're saying that kind of how South Africa functions as the breadbasket for sub-Saharan Africa, the United States functions that as a breadbasket for the world.
It will be used as a breadbasket for the world after the population's reduction. I mean, it is right now as well, but it will be more so. And I think that's the elite's plan more than it is to allow unchecked immigration and suburbanization. You know, like we're going to live in one giant suburb from California to Massachusetts. It's just going to be those, you know, row houses after row houses.
In some ways, like, there could be some aspects where the quality of life might actually be higher than it is now for some people. Like, there might be certain ways, if things go as you're talking about, but for the vast majority, it will be pretty ugly.
Well, I have a unique perspective because I see both sides, and that's because I want to see both sides. Some days I'm around the ultra rich, and some days I choose to go to trailer parks just to study things and talk to.
How would you describe, like, your personal, like, background as far as your class and overall background?
Well, it's kind of complex because my ancestor was George Washington's quartermaster general for a while in the Continental Army. So I have, what do they call, heritage American background, and I also have Native American background. I'm pretty blue collar stock overall, even though I have some more illustrious ancestors. So it's been kind of downhill for the last century.
As far as interviewing people, like, have you covered the whole theme of, like, the deaths of despair, alcoholism, opioids, and suicide?
I have. One of the big chunks of the documentary is going to do with meth, because meth is more prevalent in the heartland than the opioids, though opioids are very prevalent. In fact, opioids are so prevalent that they cut meth. They cut the meth with heroin. And so meth is not the same meth that it was when we think of methamphetamines in the past, you know, that speeds up people. It's actually it has morphed into something else now. It's both a painkiller and a stimulant because it's cut with heroin. And heroin is so prevalent, but nevertheless, it's not common in an opioid form. It's common in meth, in the cut meth. What they call Mexican ice, that is manufactured in Mexico and actually subsidized by Walmart, believe it or not. Though I don't know if we'll go into that in the documentary.
Walmart did play a role in destroying a lot of small town America, but that's not so much. You're documenting the ongoing issues. That was a huge issue in the 80s and 90s.
Well, the deal, I can talk about that on this show, but the deal with Walmart is, Walmart uses vendors for everything, and a lot of its vendors are from Mexico, and they also happen to own the actual factories, because meth is made in factories now. It's not just made in, people think of people cooking meth in the United States in a bathtub or whatever. People don't do that, or Walter White cooking meth, you know, in his home laboratory. There's no money in that. The lab, right now, they mass produce meth in factories in Mexico. And consequently, Walmart uses its vendor connections, or helps the vendors with their connections, to basically bring tons of meth into the country every year. So a lot of people are on meth and use it as a painkiller more, because it's cut with heroin. And yes, there are a lot of people on opioids as well, fentanyl and so on, but it's very commonplace now in any case. And certainly what's happening to white people is what was happening to Native American Indians.
If you look up ethnic statistics on suicides, the two highest groups it's actually both whites and Native Americans, with the other groups as being lower. Why do you think it's those two groups?
They're redundant peoples. And when they say whites, we largely mean the Scots-Irish, some Italians, Germans, those people of those particular descent, you know, Nordic whites, some Southern European whites, so forth and so on. But like I said, the genocide has been going on the reservations for 30, 40, 50, 60 years. So it's hard to feel particular sympathy for the whites when they watch the genocide going on, you know, to the Indians for a long time. And, you know, there was no easy solution to the problem. And, you know, some of the particular tribes were able to solve the problem by starting a tribal company in which all the men were employed in construction or something like that.
Do you have family on reservations, or are you fairly assimilated into sort of mainstream American society?
I'm fairly assimilated, but I do have relations on reservations.
Do you talk about what's going on with cash businesses such as gas stations, motels, laundromats?
You mean in the documentary?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of them are obviously immigrant-owned, but what's the significance of them?
I was really bothered for a long time by the fact that they're all forms of cash businesses are foreign-owned. And again, this goes back to talking about the reservations and the Indians and giving them, you know, giving the tribes casinos and so forth, which were immediately taken over by the mafia. So the Indians are just getting a small pittance from the casino, and the, you know, various mafias and cartels are reaping the reward from the large profits from the casinos and giving the tribes a very small amount of the profits. So what happens with the gas stations? Any cash business has been farmed out to some foreign cartel, family, clan, or something. So you see Pakistanis, Indians running gas stations. You'll see Chinese running laundries, and so forth and so on.
And this isn't just in these traditional immigrant gateways like New York and California. You'll see this in small towns in Alabama.
Yes, in every gas station in America is owned by an Indian, or every hotel is owned, an East Indian. Every hotel is owned by a Pakistani and so forth and so on. And what these people are, people don't understand the clan structure. The deal is that the U.S. intelligence has made a deal with certain clans in Pakistan and India to allow their people, their families, to withdraw large amounts of cash from America in order for their support against China. And so forth.
With China was being built up through the 90s of the neoliberal free trade era, but now China is being vilified as like fascist. So India is being built up as this rival, as a counterbalance to China.
Well, all through the 90s, India was being built up too.
Oh yeah, for sure.
So I think we have to remember that the elites don't all get along, and that's where
conspiracy theorists, they view elites as just one monolithic entity when there are divisions. Like you said, there's the different layers from the 100 million multimillionaires to billionaires, and then the millionaires at the bottom. The thing is, like, there's also ideological divisions, so that's what conspiracy theorists get wrong. They have this kind of vision that there's just this one tiny group that meets in secret, when it's this whole apparatus in general. It's not just this one tiny shadowy group.
Yeah, I would imagine that the different groups supporting China and India coexist at the moment, and whether they intend to continue doing so. It's like the groups that support Israel, you know, and Saudi
Arabia. Yeah, because there's factions of the establishment that are less friendly to Israel. It's not monolithic.
Yeah, exactly. So all this is going on, but nobody considers American interests or the interests of the Americans. And what they would tell you if you confronted them with that is, hey, we had to give all these cash businesses away to foreigners in order to use their clout to maintain peace through, in other words, to buy friends abroad. Otherwise, we'd already be in a shooting war with China. And so consider it a small price to pay that instead of owning a gas station, you're working construction or working in, you know, some other field that most native-born Americans go into. because you don't have access to that easy cash, because so we don't have to, you have to sacrifice your access to that easy cash, so we don't have a hot war with China right now or a hot war with Russia. That's what they would say is as their justification for enabling, you know, foreigners to basically take over all these easy businesses.
As far as providing jobs, do you have personal solutions to what can be done? I mean, this whole idea of, like, kind of make work jobs, but there are kind of also, there's what society can do as a whole, and then there are these kind of economic niches. So these different tribes you're talking about, they also have businesses that are passed down through the family, and that's kind of how, that's probably more how it used to be, but there is just this kind of radical individualist mindset in this country where everyone has to kind of start from scratch. Or I'd say, like, anyone in the bottom 80 or even 90%, there's this mentality that everyone has to start from scratch.
Well, Hyland was a neoliberal, and he said specialization is for insects. And I very much disagree with him. I think that specialization is important, and I think for those people that do survive this current trend, it's going to be a father passing down his trade to his son, and people engaging, having some appreciation for family inheritances, trying to leave stuff for their children, trying to consider their family as the basis for their future.
Yeah, I mean, there's you go to, like, some towns in Europe, and you have people who the same business, maybe might be like an inn, and the same, like, heirlooms, like, it's all been passed down, like, many generations. I mean, part of it is just how America was created as, like, a frontier society where everything is disposable and you restart from scratch. You move one area has problems and you keep moving further west. But, like, neoliberalism kind of, it accelerates that whole trend in American culture where everything is disposable and each generation starts from scratch.
Well, my theory on that, on starting from scratch, is that America is, geographically speaking, not meant to really be inhabited like Europe. And what I mean by that is America is fundamentally, the way the geography lays, it makes people nomadic. And that's why the American Indians and all the tribes were nomadic. And what you see is that the whites who settled the American continent have become nomadic. Well, not by their own choosing, but they have inadvertently become nomadic by the fact that they could not build that kind of environment that was in Europe. And there's many reasons for that, but I think geography is one of them. Just the very nature of the geography in the United States causes people to become nomadic. And so they want to start over. They have no choice to start over. At first it becomes a desire, then it becomes a matter of life or death. You know, you have to start over somewhere else. You can't make it here anymore. You can't make it there anymore. You've got to do something else. You've got to go somewhere else. And that just becomes inevitable for 90% of the population.
You saw that documentary, TFW No GF. Alex Lee Moyer, she touches upon economics briefly, but would you say the people portrayed in that documentary, are they relevant to what you're doing with yours?
I think mine is more, I'm looking for a different class of people that maybe I feel more comfortable in interacting with, that I feel like are more heritage Americans, because everybody can have the facsimile of being a heritage American, but unless you can trace your direct ancestry back to the 13 colonies or beyond that, you know, you're not really a heritage American. It's very easy to profile white people in general, but it's hard to profile particular Americans. And what I found is that the heritage Americans, like people who are descended from actual settlers, I consider them to be particularly targeted.
So with these different like blocks in the country, like the people of the Midwest and the people of the South, and where they trace their ancestry to, as far as like which groups are having more, like, which groups are more deracinated, which groups have more social cohesion based on their own lifestyle, and then which groups are being more targeted?
Well, Robert, first of all, I'd like to answer that with one of the most important things when you're studying this matter is to understand that the greatest currency in the world today is anonymity. And our elites have the most of this currency. So it's hard to profile our elites in general. No, I'm not talking about the top secret Bohemian Grove. I'm talking about the lower tier elites, You know, any elites take advantage of anonymity for themselves and their families as much as possible. So it's very hard to profile the elites. And insofar as what I have profiled them, I'm afraid to talk about them in particular. Now, on the other hand, it's very easy to profile the peasants and the helots.
One example I'll give is that looking at suicide rates is that in the South, there is a lot of poverty, but suicide rates are lower, actually lower in the South, deep South, than they are in the Rust Belt because they still have stronger social cohesion.
I think there's more Christianity in the deep South than the Rust Belt, but it's starting to fade as well. I told one of the lines I liked in an interview in the documentary was saying the Southern Baptists went from beer to meth in one generation or less. And so that's ongoing right now, you know, so that is...
Well, there's some groups like, say Mormons in Utah. Do you see them thriving more in the long term?
I think the Mormons have their own deal with the elites and the government.
There are a lot of Mormons in the deep state, so they're thriving much more, but you would say, is it...
I think the groups that are going to survive are the ones that make a deal with the elites and are strong enough to stand up for themselves to a certain degree. And those groups are not necessarily in the forefront right now. In other words, they're going to become more evident over time, be they Mormons or Jehovah's Witness, or, you know, there are going to be various different organizations that make a truce with the elites and are able to survive the purges down the road. But
with your documentary, I know there's the stories, the documenting these communities that have been devastated, but what are you going to do in the documentary to make your point about the future trends, about what you see happening, what you predict is going to happen?
I don't know how much predictions I'm going to put into the documentary specifically. What I wanted to do more document or actually make a record of all the small towns. Like, well, there's literally thousands of small towns that might have had a factory, two gas stations, a cafe, a couple of other buildings. They might have had less than 1,000 people in them, but they had some business going on, and that's slowly dying. The buildings are falling in, the glass is broken, everything is falling apart. There are a few residences left in the town. There's a post office. But by and large, everything is falling apart. Everything is decaying. Everybody in the town is on drugs. The mayor, the chief of police, they go and hang out in City Hall and hit the crack pipe. And this is not exceptional or unusual. And I don't really want to necessarily draw conclusions on this. I just merely want to just document or leave a record of all this happening.
With documentaries, some documentaries are explicitly political. I agree. I think it would be more effective if you just tell the stories without any explicit political angle.
Well, at this point, I don't know who to be political for again, because the vast majority, a prerequisite for being political is having human beings, and if you don't have any human beings, you can't have politics. And we're dealing with a large quantity of zombies in the United States who are never going to be awakened from their stupor to the reality of their situation. And were they awakened from their stupor, they would be incapable of any kind of intelligent action to prevent their own downfall. So, again, the best thing to do is just to leave that history behind in film.
We touched on this already, but what outcomes do you see happening? The long-term trends that we should look out for after the pandemic?
I think you're going to see a lot of people selling, like the whole meat shortage. I think there's going to be a lot of more local sales of meat because
what's going on, it does bring light to a lot of the problems of factory farming, especially, I mean, a lot of people who maybe were not like hardcore environmental rights activists or environmentalists are finding out a lot of the ugly sides.
Yeah, I think there's going to be a lot more local selling of meat from individual owners. So in other words, small beef producers for the time being, while they still exist, are going to be selling more beef out of their own local places to individuals. And for the time being, in the short term, in the long term, I think they're going to potentially try to cut down on the sales of beef overall in the country because beef is a nourishing sustenance for the population that they want to reduce. So I really see them cutting drastically back on the amount of beef available to the public. And chicken and pork are food for more docile people, so they'll be feeding them more of the factory farm chicken and pork. And I see, again, a lot of businesses closing. But primarily what's interesting, and one of the things I've noticed in the last couple of years, and I want to document in this documentary, are the number of small-town banks that are being closed, because banks are in every small town in America. No matter how run down the town is, it usually has a nice bank. And when the bank dies, the whole town dies. So I wanted to chronicle all these little banks, not necessarily independent banks. A lot of them are chain banks, but all the little banks that are being pulled out of businesses by the chains or basically rendered closed down and unavailable to the people. So I see that continuing. Once the banks go, the businesses will no longer have a lifeline because all they do is borrow money from the banks, and the banks hold the mortgages and all that. So once the banks go, people are not going to have that lifeline of credit anymore. So that's going to make life harder for them and for anybody who wants to invest or get a loan to start a business. It's going to be virtually impossible. Yeah, I see that happening. You know, as a result, partially of this coronavirus, this whole epidemic and the quarantine, is that a lot of the banks were carrying so many mortgages for public properties or businesses, restaurants, and so forth and so on.
Yeah, it will lead to this kind of mass consolidation where the bigger banks and real estate firms will, what I said earlier with the farms, of the businesses that become bankrupt or foreclosed, they'll just be this mass buy-up. So I think like these trends of income inequality will definitely accelerate.
I think income inequality is, it's like I said, we're returning to normal, and it may take a long time to return to normal. And of course, inequality is the norm for humanity, unfortunately. And we have to deal with the fact that Americans were living in a imaginary utopia for about 50 years prior to World War II. But that time is over, and that's time to suffer.
Do you have examples from other parts of the world, that countries that are ahead of us, that basically show that we're the direction we're headed, like where we could be in, say, 30 years?
I think Brazil, with its favelas, is California is certainly going to look like Brazil with its favelas. But what people don't understand is that Brazil is a political crucible, and those favelas, they're not the overpopulation that produced them is being reduced at this time through birth control and various methods. So yes, the United States, particularly California and other states like that, are going to resemble Brazil for a while, but people think it's going to be a permanent condition. It's nothing. Nothing's permanent, as Heraclitus pointed out. You know, history is a river, and the water passes by. So, but we are going to have to deal with favelas, and in a lot of places, you can document, like, you get out of the nice inner part of town in cities.
Oh, the new thing is, like, there used to be, like, the inner city ghetto and the white flight to the suburbs, but actually the new trend now is suburban ghettos. I mean, you're in the Midwest. I think the best example of that would be Ferguson. But the thing is, they exist for the white proletariat as well.
Well, Ferguson was a suburb. I don't know what exactly happened with Ferguson. I've been to Ferguson.
You're talking about just these kind of like slum-like communities just popping up all over the country.
Well, let's look at St. Louis in general. St. Louis does not have a reason to exist anymore. St. Louis was a riverport town, and it's no longer a riverport town because the Mississippi River is no longer used for serious, you know, economic business for the most part. And so St. Louis doesn't have factories. It doesn't have industry. It doesn't have agriculture. It doesn't have a real reason to exist. It's just a conglomeration of population. And it's again, I use the word crucible. It's a crucible of peoples fighting amongst each other. You have the Bosnians and the blacks and the Hispanics and all these different peoples, ethnicities fighting for a piece of the pie, but there's nothing in St. Louis of value particularly. The city is not worth anything. So what happens is general ghettoification. I know that's not a word, but the whole city is turning into a ghetto from the inside out. You go downtown in St. Louis, it looks like a war zone. Then you go outside to the suburbs, it also doesn't look that great, you know?
Paul, do you have a website to promote yourself or to promote this project? And are you doing anything to raise funds, like a Kickstarter?
I'm fixing to start a Patreon, but I don't really have one up yet. But I think enough people know who I am where they can get a hold of me and give me money.
What's the best way to get in touch with you?
Oh, I guess Facebook. My name, Paul Bingham, the numbers 44 at yahoo.com. Yeah, I'm just saying that's the best way to reach me.
Paul Bingham, it has been an excellent show. Thank you so much for being on.
Thank you, Robert. I enjoyed talking to you.